an hour on second lecture here on ethics, and we'll look at the Christian view of ethics. It's based on God's will, and God never wills something contrary to his good nature. So the Christian view of ethics is based on God's will. It's absolute in that God's nature does not change. You know, 1 Samuel 15:29, he was the glory of Israel, does not change, or does not lie or change his mind, for he is not a man that he would change his mind. The moral obligation, the moral absolutes are always binding everywhere on everyone. But God may also give temporary commands, like the Old Testament ceremonial laws. So, you know, there's a sense where, you know, I mean, even marriage is a temporary thing in that, you know, once a husband and wife die, you know, in the resurrection, they'll neither be married nor given in marriage, says Jesus. God's moral laws are based on God's revelation in nature, or general revelation. Look at Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2. Verses 14 and 15, Paul says this: "And when Gentiles who do not have the law," they didn't have God's law written on tablets of stone, were written in the Old Testament, so the Gentiles, the pagans, "for when Gentiles who do not have the law, by nature do the things in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them." So deep down inside, in our conscience, in our hearts, we have knowledge of right and wrong because God created us in his image. God placed that in us. I don't even think, you know, one of the reasons why God started writing books to us was that we were lying against God's revelation of himself in nature, whether revealing his existence to us through creation or him revealing his moral laws to us in our conscience. And so God said, "Hey, I'm going to write it in, you know, black and white. You're going to get my written revelation." So natural or general revelation, and that's Romans 2, 14 and 15, but also supernatural or special revelation. Special because not all mankind receives it. Supernatural because God miraculously reveals something. We have access to God's supernatural revelation in his word, the 66 books. So, you know, Micah 6:8, "He has shown you, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of you, but to love..." What is it? "But to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God." I left something out. Love mercy. I gotta go back to it.
"He has told you, O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God."
Okay. So some translations read, but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. And so God has shown us in writing, Exodus 21, the Ten Commandments. God showed the Jews, he summed up over 600 commands that he gave them in the Old Testament. He summed them up in 10 commands. Okay? And the 10 commandments in the book of Exodus, the first four deal with our relationship with God. And the last six deal with our relationship with man, with our neighbor. Okay? Now, Jesus sums up, so this sums up over 600 commands. Jesus then sums up the Ten Commandments with love God with everything you got and love your neighbor as yourself. Okay? It's like Mark 12, 30 and 31. And I think what Jesus is talking about here, love God with everything you got, love your neighbor as yourself, that's the spirit of the law. Paul tells us that we're no longer under the letter of the law, we're under the spirit of the law. And so it's all about a personal love, trust relationship with Jesus, which empowers us to love God with everything we got, love our neighbors, ourselves. But this is all what God reveals to us through the scriptures, through supernatural or special revelation. Now, the moral law is prescriptive. Ethics do not merely describe what is. Ethics prescribe what ought to be. So moral laws are prescriptive, not descriptive. That's why acknowledging a moral law necessitates finding the moral law giver. Also, Christian view of ethics, they are deontological ethics in that the rule determines what is right. So they're deontological, they're not teleological. Deontological, not teleological. Deontological rules determine what is right. Teleological, from the Greek word telos, or end or goal, the results determine what is right. It's like Karl Marx and the end justifies the means. Those utilitarians, if ending poverty means exterminating 5 billion people, so be it. Boy, what a good plan for stopping poverty. Just kill all the poor people. But the idea of the results determine what's right. No, that's not the Christian view of morality. The rules determine what is right because those rules come from God. Okay? Now, I want to skip over the next section and then we'll come back to that. And because I want to look forward on page 5. Top there, get Geisler defines an absolute moral law. I guess Geisler and Feinberg was probably in their work on Introduction to Philosophy. By a universal right is meant a duty that is binding on all men at all times and in all places. So the absolute moral law. But here's the. I can't even pronounce the name. It's just the Euthyphro dilemma from Plato. And I just want to deal with that. Okay, is something good. Now, with this dilemma here in ancient Greece, it was the gods, but when applied to Christianity, it's God. Is something good merely because God wills it? Or can God only will that which is good? If something is good merely because God wills it, that seems to make the good arbitrary. God could have created a world in which murdering innocent babies is a good thing and feeding hungry people is an evil thing. So God just went eating, meeting, minding, mo, and arbitrarily chose that no, murder is evil and feeding the hungry is good. So there's a problem with that, and most traditional theologians rejected that. Most classical theologians rejected it. John Duns Scotus held to it. It's called voluntarism because there is nothing above God's will. God's will is the ultimate thing. There's no standard above God's will. Therefore, he would say, yeah, something is good merely because God willed it. Now, most classical theologians rejected that, and that's why they turned his name, Duns, into a ridicule, an insult. So you wear a dunce cap, and he's a dunce, that type of thing. But that just shows you how unpopular it was in the history of Christian thought. But the other position, God can only will that which is good. The problem with that, it seems to introduce a standard above God that God must obey, but then how can God be God if there's a standard above him? Okay? And I'll just tell you how most classical theologians deal with this. I think Gordon Clark is a voluntarist on this, the great Presbyterian philosopher who died in the 1980s. But most, you could even say virtually all traditional theologians today, and virtually all classical theologians throughout history hold to the second, but they say, yeah, God can only will that which is good, but that doesn't mean that there's a standard above God, because God is the standard. God is by nature good, and the only thing God's will must submit to is God's good nature. Okay? And so God's nature is who he is. Well, God is good. God is good. We have goodness only because God gave it to us. But God is the source of all good, is good. God is love. We have love, but he gave it to us. God is existence. We have existence because God gave it to us. It's actually impossible for God not to exist. But God is holy. So we understand that God, by his nature, is good, and his will only is subservient to his own good nature, then God can only will that which is good, but the standard's not above God. God is the standard. Okay? So that's the way most classical theologians, you can do that also with logic. something logical merely because God wills it? Or can God only will that which is logical? Well, guess what? God is logic. That's why Jesus is called the Logos. We get our word logic from that Greek word for the word. And as a logical, rational God, he wills that which is rational. As a good God, he wills that which is good. So just a little bit further there on the Christian view of right and wrong. Now go back to page 2. And the 6 main ethical systems. Norman Geisler spent so much time on these. We're just going to talk about it in a few minutes, okay? The 3 relativistic systems, there's so much overlap here, you know. I mean, you could say that Joseph Fletcher, the founder of situation ethics, you could say he's also a generalist and an antinomian. I mean, that's how much overlap there is. It kind of depends. The moral relativist, who says there is no right or wrong for all, that applies to all people, all times, and all places, there's different ways that we can categorize that. There's also different moral relativists that would focus on one aspect and others would focus on a different aspect. So let's just look at the 3 options for moral relativists, and then the 3 options for moral absolutists. Okay, so there's the antinomianism. Okay, and that's the purest form of moral relativism. There are no moral laws. Okay, anti, no, the Greek word nomos for law. Antinomianism, no moral laws. So, lying is neither right nor wrong. There really is no such thing as right and wrong. Joseph Fletcher was a Princeton theologian, or ethicist. I think he did study theology, though. Situation ethics. Joseph Fletcher. And, well, he had some weird ideas. He was big on animal-human hybrids and theorized on all that kind of stuff. But he would basically say there's only one absolute law, and that's love. Okay? And only one absolute law, that's love. And ethics are relative to the situation. So the situation decides how love is to be applied. So lying is sometimes right. So the situation determines how love is to be applied. Now, let me say this. My view is actually very close to Fletcher's situation ethics, except for 2 things. Number one, He leaves love undefined. I view love as biblically defined and biblically described. So I get direction from God's word that Fletcher doesn't get. So Jesus says, look, I'm going to sum up the whole law. Love God with everything you got. Love your neighbor as yourself. So in the end, it's all about love. But love is defined by God, not love is defined by CNN. Okay? So if I think, well, I'm supposed to love my neighbor as myself, and I'm a pastor, there's a gay couple that wants to get married, they ask me to perform the wedding, since I'm supposed to love my neighbor as myself, I guess the loving thing to do would be to perform their wedding. Well, you read the Bible, and the Bible makes it pretty clear that God doesn't accept homosexual marriage. He refers to homosexuality as an abomination. So, loving my neighbor, I'm going to define love biblically, not leave it undefined, so their political correctness can make it whatever they want to make it. I'm going to see that the loving thing to do to that couple is to say, hey, you guys need to get right with Jesus. The biblical view of marriage is one man and one woman for one lifetime. You got to get right with God. And I love you too, and I'm praying for you, and I'd love to see you too in heaven someday. But you're going to have to find somebody else. I can't take part in this. And if the government orders me to take part in it, I'm going to engage in civil disobedience and say no. And then I got to decide, am I going to stay home or am I going to run for the hills? And then the government's got to decide whether I stay home and run for the hills. Is it even worth it to go and get me and lock me up? I mean, you know, but I'm going to define love the way God defines it. Okay? You know, love is the unconditional seeking the greatest good for others. And you expect nothing in return. Well, seeking the greatest good for two homosexuals would not be, if you really love them, you're not going to perform their way.
Well, another problem with situation ethics is because that even if love was accurately defined, you were allowing the individual under the system to justify any action whatsoever. Well, of course I robbed that bank. How else am I going to give money to the poor? Because I love them so much.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is that would be a misuse. You'll see when I explain my view, that would definitely be a misuse of it. At the same time, there are places where something similar to that, I think, would be justified. I stole that loaf of bread because we're in the tribulation. I refused to accept the mark of the beast. I couldn't buy it, and my child was starving. You know, I lied to the government authorities because the two Jewish spies hiding on my roof were innocent men, and this is a godless government here, so I lied and sent them in the wrong direction to rescue the lives of those innocent men. And I'll explain it.
Well, that is God's standard being held above the standard of men.
Yeah.
I have no problem with that. But
yeah.
Giving something as nebulous as love allows the individual to justify and rationalize it.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, though, is I think even Jesus, though, said, look, when everything's said and done, it's not the rules and regulations. It's about loving God with everything you got and loving your neighbor as yourself. So even if you love your neighbor as much as you love God or more than you love God, that's called idolatry. So it's got to be the proper thing, but I think God's laws are guidelines to help us. I mean, look at how many different situations are spelled out in the scriptures. And I also don't think that the situation doesn't determine what is right and what is wrong. But the situation can help us define which of God's laws do apply and so how love should act in a particular situation. So, but we'll get to it when we get to the different views, because I am a moral absolutist. And he would claim to be an absolutist and say that he holds to one absolute. But when you leave your one absolute undefined, I mean, Joseph Fletcher's love, wouldn't you illustrate, you get, I robbed the bank to give the money to the poor people or something, where the way he defines it, he has a choice to make. Either he can tell that guy, no, that's not my concept of love, so automatically Joseph Fletcher becomes the moral lawgiver. Or he could say, well, if that's how you display love, if that's what love tells you to do, you know, and so basically either Fletcher is playing God and he's a moral absolutist, but he's playing God, he's the moral lawgiver, which he would deny, or he's leaving love undefined and then he's a relativist.
In which case, you know, I would confront him with Amnon and Tamar. Amnon could very well have said he loved his sister and he chose to rape her. What do you say to him?
Yeah. No, Fletcher, it will come down to, Fletcher's going to do two things. And the little that I've read of Fletcher, he's going to dogmatically declare that, you know, when a Christian tries to get Christian morality taught in the public schools, that's unloving. So Fletcher's going to play God and be a moral absolutist as long as he's on the throne when it comes to the Christian. But when two guys love each other and want to get married, Fletcher is going to say, we have no right to force our definition of love on them, and so that he leaves love undefined. So he's going to vacillate between two positions there. But I do think there's something about that love. And in other words, the way I would say it is the two mega absolutes are love God with everything you got, love your neighbor as yourself. Any other absolutes flow from that. And then there are an awful lot of things that we teach, moral commands that we teach as absolutes, but they're actually just very general commands. Like even, thou shalt not bear false witness. But you see at least two instances of lying in the scriptures that God commends. Rahab the harlot, and the two the Hebrew midwives in Egypt. They're lying to the Pharaoh and they say, oh, these Jewish women, they're a strong woman, they have their babies before we get there to deliver them, because if we were there, we would have delivered them and then drowned them in the Nile, like you commanded. Well, they were lying, and God's word took, so we'll have to deal with that when we get to moral absolutism. And then generalism. You have some very general commands but no universal or absolute ones. So lying is generally wrong. It might be right sometimes though, okay? But they would say that about everything. So murder is generally wrong. But I guess there's a good time to murder. Those are the moral relativistic positions, okay? My own view is going to totally reject antinomianism. It's going to reject situation ethics, but recognize that there's something about love, because Jesus told us the whole law loving God or you got loving your neighbor as yourself. The situation can help us define what God's law, how love could be applied, but it doesn't mean the situation. It's God's will is the determining factor, but the situation might help us define God's will, is what I'm trying to say. And then generalism, I will agree on this point, though I disagree when they say there's no universal absolute commands, I do think many commands in the scriptures that we think are absolute may actually just be general commands. Okay? So we'll get to it when I share my, I need to write something on it because I'm the only guy in the world that I know of that holds my view. There might be others, but I don't know of any. So that's moral relativism. Now let's look at three different views on moral absolutism. The first is unqualified absolutism. This is like the Amish people, the Quakers. Qualified absolutism. I think it's also called the third alternative view. There's always a way out. So absolute moral laws never conflict. What's his name? John Piper. I don't think he holds to this, but he sure sounded like he did when he talked about gun control. And a very conservative guy in his theology and fairly conservative in his politics, but then all of a sudden he came out with this thing. He acted like he bought the lie that guns kill people. Not people using guns to kill people, but guns. Yeah, so Piper ended up saying that Christians shouldn't own guns. I think you look at the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus is saying, look, you know, this is something that we Christians who are constitutionalists, who believe in human rights and constitutional rights, our God-given rights, we need to recognize, Jesus says, if you get what you deserve, you get hell. So since we're under grace and under the law, we shouldn't really be that concerned about our rights. At the same time, so I will fight for the right to bear arms, for freedom of speech, freedom of religion, but if I'm going to do it in a Sermon on the Mount manner, I'm going to do it for the good of society and for the good of my family. I'm not going to do it. It's all about me. So, even a guy who lives alone, doesn't have a wife and kids, if somebody breaks into his house and he has to shoot him, it doesn't have to be just for his rights. If that guy successfully robs him, he's much more likely to then attempt to rob somebody else. And if somebody catches him, is he going to kill them? So I agree with Piper on that. We shouldn't be so concerned about our rights. But he goes to the point where somebody's trying to attack your wife.
No, he said let him. You let him.
Yeah, yeah.
Tolerance is letting your neighbor, loving your neighbor enough to let him rape your wife.
Yeah, and that's just ludicrous, you know. Did he actually say it in those words or just ballpark close?
Generally speaking, what he said he would do. Okay. Absolutely.
But it was to the point where he wouldn't protect his wife. And John Piper has done a lot of good. But on this particular point, that Amish thing, that Quaker thing, that Mennonite thing, where if somebody's going to beat up your loved one, it would be a sin for you to fight them. I don't see that in scriptures at all. Okay? And I think if you want to get married, you are obligated to do the best you can to protect your loved ones. And but that's unqualified absolutism. Absolute moral laws never conflict. Now, without being Amish and Quaker, I'm going to pull some good out of that. And we'll see that in just a minute. Then there's conflicting absolutism. Conflicting absolutism. This is where when moral laws conflict, you can't obey two. You basically obey, you're obligated to do the lesser of two evils, and then you can get forgiveness. So you do the lesser evil, and ask for forgiveness. This was the view that the Lutheran scholar John Ward Montgomery held to. And but the Bible doesn't seem to indicate that the Hebrew midwives in Egypt or Rahab the harlot had to ask for forgiveness. Okay? So the lesser evil view, conflicting absolutism, seems to be something wrong with it. Then there's graded absolutism. You do the greater of two goods. You do the greater good. Okay? And so Rahab the harlot would say, okay, it is good to submit to the governing authorities. It is good not to lie to the governing authorities, but it is even better, it is a greater good to protect innocent human life. And so, this is St. Augustine's view, and Norman Geisler holds this view, and I used to hold this view. You do the greater good, and then God gives you an exemption. It's not an exception. There's no exceptions to the absolute moral law, but God gives you an exemption from the lesser good. So you don't have to ask forgiveness. So in other words, the good thing to do in that situation was lie and not submit to the Canaanite governing authorities so that you could save the lives of the two Jewish spies. I used to hold this view, but if we define a moral absolute as something that applies to all people at all times and all places, if we got an exemption from it, was it really an absolute? Did it apply to all people at all times and all places? And so my view is very similar to this, but takes stuff even from the relativist and unqualified absolutism. Here's what my view, I call it unqualified. So if it's a moral absolute, it applies to all people at all times and all places. Unqualified, minimal absolutism. So like the Amish and the Quakers, I say, look, God's moral laws, God's absolute moral laws, there's no exceptions or exemptions, okay? You have to obey them at all times, in all places, and that applies to all people, okay? But I believe that the number of these absolutes is probably a lot less than we think they are. So, because God gave Rahab the harlot and the Hebrew midwives an exemption from thou shalt not lie, that tells me that those commands weren't absolutes. They were only general commands. So, you know, Ten Commandments, we think, well, that's about as absolute as it gets. Oh, is it really? Because certainly you want to worship the one true God, not bow down before false idols. You want to not take God's name in vain. But do we keep holy the Sabbath day? Most Christians would say that one no longer applies because Jesus fulfilled it by being our Sabbath rest. You can't say, well, Sunday replaced Sabbath, because Sunday is the first day of the week. Sabbath means the seventh day. What about thou shalt not bear false witness? Rahab the harlot bore false witness, and God commended her, same to the Hebrew midwives. So I think that even among the Ten Commandments, we could find, I don't think it's ever right to covet. I cannot see any instance where it would be right to commit adultery. So I see those as absolutes. Murder, it would depend how you translate that. If it's thou shalt not kill, then it's only a general command, because sometimes God authorizes killing, whether it's in self-defense or fighting in a just war, or God commanding the Jews to wipe out the pagans. But some scholars would translate that, thou shalt not murder, which by definition means unauthorized killing, a killing not authorized by God. So if it's murder, yeah, then it's a moral absolute. So basically what I'm saying is, you got Jesus saying the mega absolutes, love God with everything you got, love your neighbor as yourself. The whole law summed up in that. Those are the mega absolutes. From those flow other moral absolutes, such as thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not covet. Okay? But even thou shalt not steal, I could see a situation, you know, if you're fleeing the Nazis, and you're starving to death, and there's an opportunity to steal some food to stay alive, it might be justified. So basically what I'm saying is, if it is a moral absolute, there's no exceptions or exemptions. So it'd be unqualified, but there's probably a lot less moral absolutes than we often think. Now, I'm not asking for us, for Christian pastors, to start figuring out exactly which ones are absolutes and which ones are just general. What you do is you teach your children and you teach your flock the commands that obviously are not just for a particular people at a particular time and place, like animal sacrifices and a certain diet and feast days. But you teach the commands that seem to be for all mankind. You teach them as absolutes, but you hope and you pray that your children or your flock will recognize that some moral commands are going to hold more weight than others. And so in other words, I would teach kids that it's sometimes okay to lie. But I hope that by teaching them moral commands and God's priorities, that our submission to God is more important than our submission to government. It's like Romans 13, 1 to 7, you applied my unqualified minimal absolutism. Paul says, submit to the governing authorities in all things. Yet, Paul, recognizing that Jesus said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. When Caesar tries to take what rightfully only belongs to God, then we don't submit to the government. That's why Paul got beheaded. So, our submission to God is greater than our submission to government. So when we can't do both, we submit to God. Okay? And God is more important than anything else, but people are more important than things. Okay? So when we put the priorities there, you teach them as absolutes, but you hope that if your kid, your child grows up and is in that situation where they have a moral conflict, you hope that they'll see God's will in that situation, and it might be, you know, lying to the Gestapo. It might be, I'm open to the possibility, it might be lying to the government. If the government says spanking is child abuse, and you're a Christian, you spank your child, and you won't get your child back, if you, you know, say, oh yeah, I spanked him, but I'm sorry, I will never do it again. I'd rather you lie to the government and then you get your kids back if you're good parents, than tell the truth to the government and then they snatch your kids away and you have no idea who's going to raise your kids. And so the Gestapo, when they showed up, when the Nazis showed up at Corey Ten Boom's house, wanted to know if there were innocent Jews hiding in their house, the Ten Booms lied. And so, with my unqualified minimal absolutism, I think that's the best explanation for moral conflict. So, it retains God's moral absolutes. At the same time, it explains in tough situations, a guy's coming to rape your wife, you're bigger than him, take him down. You're bigger and stronger than him, take him down. If you don't think you're big enough and strong enough, it only takes a shovel to be an equalizer, you know? You know, the expression, over my dead body. You get married, if somebody wants to mess with your bride, it's over your dead body, and I think you're being a godly man. Founding fathers had to deal with issues like this. Do we submit to King George? And I actually think the colonialism of Great Britain, I think that moves towards an empire, building an empire, global government, and I think that's even a factor that comes into play. That they're like saying, look, we're a free people, we were British citizens when we came here, and now these guys are going to tell us how to run our lives when we should be able to govern ourselves. And I tell you, you read the Declaration of Independence, they had it way better than we have it today. And now I'm not calling for an armed revolution, but we're going to see when we get the just war doctrine, one of the things is you have to have a chance to win it. And I don't think we have that. So my politics is a politics of protection. When a government becomes tyrant, when the government becomes a bunch of thugs who now have a monopoly on the power, all you can do is just try to figure out, okay, how can I protect my loved ones? And I don't think there's going to be any easy answers. Okay, let's take a break. 10 minutes, 8 minutes.